Good afternoon and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for August 8th, 2017. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scominini with co-host Annie Esposito. The opinions expressed on Corporations and Democracy are those of our guests and the hosts, and not necessarily of the management of Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Our guest today is Richard Smith, author of the book Green Capitalism, The God That Failed, and a founding member of System Change, Not Climate Change. Richard wrote his PhD thesis in the history on China's class structure and the contradictions of market reform in China. He's written numerous articles on the Chinese Revolution, China's transition to capitalism, and capitalist development in China's environment. And those have heard numerous publications like Against the Current, The New Left Review, Monthly Review, and The Ecologist. Well, today we'll be talking about more than just China, how green capitalism around the entire world is a conflict in terms. Our guest has written about capitalism, capitalist economic theory, and the environment for the Journal of Ecological Economics, the online journal called Capitalism, Nature, Socialism, Real World Economics Review, Truth Out, Adbusters, and others. And 2 years ago is when his book was published, Green Capitalism, The God That Failed. And he's now completing a book later this year, and it's called China's Engine of Ecological Apocalypse. So we'll be able to get some preview on that today. So let's have a look at the myth of green capitalism. Richard Smith, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Hi, Steve and Annie. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here.
So green capitalism. You know, I honestly, these days, I think green capitalism is sort of like climate denialism. You know, it's a zombie theory which just won't die. You know, it's like, it's so ridiculous. I mean, we face this huge existential crisis. You know, if you look at today's New York Times, a front page article about climate change here in the U.S. called Climate Report Full of Warnings Awaits President, about climate change hitting America hard, and we see it all around the world. You know, Southern Europe is on fire. Look at millions of refugees from Africa fleeing north as farming is collapsing. There are four famines going on in Central Western Africa at the moment.
Four of them?
Yeah, in Sudan and other areas there. Mm-hmm. In 2015, scientists warned that on present trends, life will become impossible outside of air conditioning throughout much of the Middle East. And last week, they warned, another report warned that on present trends, the combination of heat and humidity will mean that just going outdoors, even sitting in the shade, even healthy people sitting in the shade will become deadly in South Asia before very many more decades. And people may have heard of this article by Wallace Wells a couple of weeks ago in the New York Magazine. It was called
the Doomed
Earth Catalog. Yeah. In which he catalogs the existential threats we face: death by heat, collapse of food production, climate plagues, unbreathable air, perpetual war, and so on. This just with fairly modest climate change of 2 degrees, 2 to 3 degrees or so, let alone 4 degrees or 5 degrees, that would just be a total catastrophe. So this is what we're up against. The science is indisputable, and the trends are frightening. And yet, we can't seem to change. Our economy, we live in an economy built on perpetual growth, in which we, instead of addressing the things we need to do, instead of cutting fossil fuel emissions, we have our companies are insanely going around the world producing as frantically as they can, you know, drilling under the ocean and in the Arctic and one end of the earth to the other. Instead of minimizing fossil fuel consumption, consumers seem bent on maximizing consumption. You know, global auto production is at an all-time high. People don't even buy cars anymore in America. They buy these luxury gas-hog trucks and SUVs. You know, we're burning up more fuel flying all over the world. Last year, Americans flew more than any other time, you know, as a cheapo air ad in the New York subway. I live in New York, that cheap flights make it easy to say, fuck it, hook it, let's go to travel.
Okay.
Let's travel, you know? And so that's P-H-U-K-E-T.
Right.
In Thailand, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
You're going to watch your manners now. I know this is a serious subject, but we're going to watch our manners. Why do you think that people just don't get it? Is it like 4 degrees doesn't sound like very much, like the difference between 90 degrees and 94? Is that part of it?
Yeah, it doesn't sound like so much. But, you know, humans have never experienced a 4-degree temperature change. A 4-degree rise in temperature, but we experienced a 4-degree fall in temperature a few tens of thousands of years ago. At that time, during, I forget what it was, the age it was called, but like the last ice age, but there was 2 miles of ice on where I'm sitting here in New York City. That was with a 4-degree colder world.
Mm.
With a 4-degree warmer world, if you look at that book, 6 Degrees by Mark Annis, he describes chapter by chapter. Chapter 2 is 2 degrees, chapter 3 is 3 degrees, chapter 4 is 4 degrees, and so on. It's just completely frightening, so completely alarming. Yet the irony is that we can't seem to help ourselves in this economy we live on. We're in a kind of perpetual motion machine of ever faster and ever greater growth. And instead of minimizing consumption and creating, minimizing ways to consume resources, we create new ways to use up resources ever faster, you know.
Yes.
Superfluous needs, you know, 3D printers and smart watches and hoverboards and self-driving cars and the Internet of Things, you know, and so on. And Apple search for the next big thing. Instead of making products we actually do need to be durable and long-lasting and recyclable, our best, the brightest companies hire the brightest engineers they can to make products become obsolete and disposable faster. You know, this is so crazy. I mean, as I said in some things I write, in Adam Smith, this crazy logic didn't much matter because the human population was small and factories were small and didn't have much impact. But today, when everything is produced in the millions and billions and then trashed and reproduced all over again the next day, it matters. It's huge. It matters. As Giles Slate, who wrote this book about disposable electronics, said, will America's pyramids be pyramids of waste?
Yeah, no kidding. It's also interesting what you're touching on is that even the people that do believe that it's a problem and it's human caused global warming, they think that, well, we can just transfer to green energy and it's cool.
Yes, that's the, you know, like people like Bill McKibben and the World Watch people and these kind of things. There's a tremendous, it's true that fossil fuels consumption, fossil fuel burning is the major driver of CO2 emission. Not the only, but it's the major driver.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a tendency to think that, well, if we can just shift to energy, to renewable energy, then we can more or less carry on as we're living now. You know, we'll just switch to electric cars instead of gasoline-powered cars. And we can still have cars, and we can still have the same level of, more or less the same level of consumption. But this is, as I argued in my books and stuff, that this is just completely delusory. This is completely impossible because we live in a fossil fuel economy. The whole economy is built on fossil fuels. It's not just energy. That's only about 17% of fossil fuel emissions in the United States. It's higher in China, but it's only about 17% in the U.S. The rest is transportation, autos and airplanes and ships and trains. Agriculture is about 14%. Transportation is about 20-something percent. Industry and manufacturing is another 20-something percent. So when you add all of these up, you see that fossil fuels consume throughout the whole economy. And as I said at some point, even if you replace all of the coal-fired power plants and oil-fired power plants in the United States tomorrow with green, you know, renewable energy, solar power, and windmills, you would only reduce global, only reduce U.S. emissions by about 20%.
Wow!
So we need to suppress emissions across the board in the economy, but that has to mean suppressing consumption of all kinds of other resources, automobiles, airplanes, airlines, tourism, metals, plastic, chemicals, across the economy. And this is the huge conundrum. This is why there is so much resistance. Not just by the capitalists and the corporations, but by all of us, really, because workers, consumers, we're all wedded to this system of perpetual growth. And we want to think that somehow there's a magic trick here, a magic bullet, a fix, a tech fix that we can just transition to renewable energy and that'll solve all our problems and we don't have to change much.
Yeah,
but
I remember,
the fact is, we have to change a lot, really dramatically.
I remember posting something by Derek Jensen, I think it was called Changing Light Bulbs Is Not Enough, where it was saying, what you're saying right now, you've got to stop consuming, you've got to cut back, and that's way back. And there was so much hostility that I saw in response to that post I made of Derek Jensen's work. And this is from, you know, my green colleagues. It was eye-opening for me.
Right. Because, you know, we're inertial. We don't want change. And we're relatively comfortable in this country, at least many in the middle classes and so on, you know, are okay. But, and we don't, you know, and in America, in the U.S., we don't feel climate change most of the time so severely in many places. But I live in Manhattan. And I'll tell you that, you know, prior to Sandy, I could get no audience from the left about environmental issues. They just weren't interested in this. Mm-hmm. And I had given many talks at the Left Forum and so on and so forth, and panels and whatnot, and written a bunch of stuff. But most people on the left weren't interested. But after Sandy, when Lower Manhattan was flooded and Brooklyn was flooded, suddenly they woke up and they said, oh, wait a minute, maybe there's something to this. And so people began paying attention. And so it was out of that we formed this group, System Change, Not Climate Change, which is a coalition composed of people from Solidarity, the Socialist Party, the Green Party, and various other socialist groups, which then kind of reformed themselves as eco-socialist groups, and we began to take that seriously. And things are much further along on that road in Europe than here. But still, even here, after Sandy, that had a big impact. And right now, across the country, there are areas where the environment is under huge stress, like the Southwest and in parts of California. Oregon, Portland had a temperature of 107.
I know. 110 in some neighborhoods.
I grew up, had a temperature of 104. I mean, you never had temperatures of 104 when I was a kid in Seattle.
New Orleans was underwater again this week. Many neighborhoods, anyway, with all their pumps working, they couldn't keep up with it.
There you go. See, so I mean, it's the impact of these ecological climate disasters is only going to grow, and the difficulty is whether we can make people rise up sufficiently to want to change it before it's too late to bother trying. You know. But we have to assume that it's never going to be too late to bother trying, because what else can we do? That's what we have to do. We have to fight as much as we can to save ourselves.
Well, I guess we're up against some people who believe in Armageddon and this the new right, the religious right, but seems to be calling the shots in Washington, D.C. right now. Is that going to be a problem of organizing? Armageddon is good. God wants it.
I think there are people there are people like that, but I don't think that most people are so crazy as that. I mean, the polls actually show that people are pretty good on environmental issues. If they, and I quoted them in my book, if people, you know, people want, for example, like high numbers of the population around the world want to see a binding limit on CO2 emissions, like 69% in America, 77% in China, and various places around the world.
Wow.
These big polls, I quoted them in my six thesis paper and in my book. And so people want people have intuitively, instinctively good attitudes about the environment. But when those environmental issues are counterposed against jobs, then it's a problem. But this is capitalism. And no one giving, when you say, well, okay, in order to save the humans, we need to close down companies like Exxon, Mobil, General Motors, Boeing, Apple, Monsanto, United Airlines, you know, we need to drastically retrench production of automobiles. I'm not saying we have to completely abandon producing cars, but we have to almost abandon them. Big cars, reusable, rebuildable, like my old Volkswagen Beetle, you know, forever to last. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of producing new models every year to make them disposable and so forth. So we have a huge percentage of our industry, our economy is built on disposable products. Those just have to go by the board. I mean, we can't afford, with 7 billion going on 9 billion people on the planet, to have an economy built around disposability.
Yeah,
it's just suicide.
But we
have to have a completely different kind of economy. We have to close down a lot of industries. We have to retrench a lot of industries. And we have to completely reprioritize, reorganize the economy to make it align with the needs of people rather than the needs of shareholders, a narrow sector of people, and corporate bosses and capitalists. You know, that's the problem. And we can do that, I think. I mean, no guarantees here, but I think we can create a kind of rationally planned economy. There's only so many ways you can have an economy. If it's not going to be organized by the market, it's got to be organized some other way.
Yeah.
And I try to make a robust argument for comprehensive economic planning, for nationalizing most of the large corporations in America, socializing them, putting them under public ownership, because how else can no company can put itself out of business. The scientists tell us that climate scientists tell us we're going to save ourselves. We need to cut CO2 emissions by 7 to 10% per year for the next few decades. Well, can you imagine Rex Tillerson, currently Secretary of State, but formerly head of Exxon, going to his shareholders and saying, well, folks, in order to save the humans, we have to cut production of oil by 7 to 10% over the next year and every year after for the next few decades. And therefore, we have to cut your profits by that over every year for the next few decades. Well, how long would it take your retirement portfolio to drop that stock?
Right, yeah, I'm trying to picture that happening.
You can say the same thing across the whole economy. But if we don't do that, we're doomed.
And so the CEOs aren't going to want to do that, and neither are we, because we don't want to give up our jobs either.
Right.
That's our survival.
We're all dependent on this economy of perpetual growth. And that didn't make much difference in the 18th century in Adam Smith's time, but today it makes a lot of difference. It's a huge, you know, imagine China growing 6 to 7% a year, let alone 10%, which it was doing a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
Let
me take a moment to just remind listeners,
yeah,
we're listening to Dr. Richard Smith. That's the author of Green Capitalism, The God That Failed. And the topic for today's program is the myth of green capitalism. We had a caller a few minutes ago, but we usually don't take them in the first half hour of the program. But we will be taking calls starting shortly after the bottom of the hour.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Oh, we've got one right now coming in. Should we go ahead and take it?
Up to you.
Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Richard Smith.
Quick comment.
Okay.
Mariah Gallardin can confirm that the greatest authorities on this earth studying climate meltdown, climate chaos, two primary problems. All of the things this fine gentleman is saying are absolutely true, but the giant Godzilla and the gorilla and elephant in the room are these trios. They combine. Lime is being burned in order to create cement concrete. The other thing is the burning of the forest. We are in control of those, especially the cement. We have got to stop that. the rebar, etc., makes cement, concrete, non-recyclable. Even the ships that are being in Bangladesh taken apart, they're recyclable if you get down to the grunt and gritty of it.
Okay, and was there a oil, third? Is oil the third one? Is oil your third point there?
Yes.
Okay, thank you so much.
And that oil needs to be turned into plastics for our buildings and other vital needs, not to be burn the bowels of the earth to put it into our small membrane.
Thanks for your call. Appreciate
Bye-bye.
It. Bye. Hi, you have a reaction to that, the ugly three there?
I think he's made some very good points. Concrete. this polymath scientist, Vaclav Smil, wrote a book a year or so ago in which he pointed out that China poured more concrete in just 3 years between 2011 and 2013 than the United States poured in the entire 20th century.
Oh, wow. Holy smoke. Oh, serious?
To build all its cities, all build new cities, mm-hmm. build ghost cities, build infrastructure and high-speed railway trains and a highway system bigger than the U.S., of course, and the world's longest high-speed railway system and endless bridges and tunnels and so on and so forth. If people are interested in the China question, look at my article called China's Communist Capital's Ecological Apocalypse.
Okay.
Same title as my book, but it's an article. Just Google that title, and you'll see it. Posted on the web in a couple, two or three places. It was in the journal of, it was in the review of economics.
Okay, we have another call. Hello, yeah. You're on the air.
Annie, not logging of the forest. The forests are being cultivated beautifully by forestry that's well managed. It's the burning of the forest.
Oh.
Burning of the forest.
Oh, sorry.
Not forestry.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thanks for that
correction. That's a very good point, too, because you know, the whole of Southeast Asia over the last few years, last decade, but especially in recent years, massive quantities of native, undisturbed ancient forests is being leveled to produce what? To produce palm oil plantations. They're burning up down, burning up the you know, the apes and the people too. You know, they're just burning it, leveling the whole vast swaths of Indonesia and Malaysia and even New Guinea to produce palm oil plantations. What for? Well, palm oil is being used as a synthetic biofuel, so to power cars and airplanes and this, that, and the other. So in other words, to keep the perpetual motion machine of growth growing forever by using a so-called green fuel. This is one of the many delusions of greening of the capitalist economy, the notion that we can switch from oil to palm oil. You know, please. Anyway, but that's what's happening. I mean, leveling the forest, and in addition, leveling the forest in the Amazon, for example, to grow soybeans for the Chinese and also for the Europeans. The French feed their chickens on soya meal from native forest in the Amazon.
Okay, so we have another call. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment about what one of the callers has just brought out.
Right.
And it has to do with what we do with the fossil fuels. I think we need to repurpose these things and everything else that we do so frequently as to make problems. If we can change what the end result is, if we can capture the CO2 when you're making concrete, if we can turn the fossil fuels into polymers and make lucite and architectural parts to replace our old infrastructure.
Okay.
We could put the CO2 perhaps in tunnels and use it as a buoyancy medium to float objects rather than the things we do. We are stuck on stupid, and we're really having a crisis in imagination.
Okay, well, you got a crisis.
And it isn't anything else other than that. So.
Okay, thank you. Crisis of imagination.
I think that's a good point. We do have a crisis of imagination because we're locked into thinking that the only kind of economy we can live in is an economy of perpetual growth. And what I and many other people before me, I'm hardly the only one, have argued that if we had a different kind of economy, we wouldn't have to be such slaves to the consumer treadmill and need to spend so much of our lifetime in work. Remember, back in the 50s and so, the apologists of capitalism would tell us how, oh, capitalism is going to grow, we'll have a shorter work day and so on and so forth. Instead, people are working two jobs to pay for stuff they can't afford, but they need, you know? I mean, you say, well, people shouldn't drive cars, but people live in suburbs and they have, you know, say you're a couple and you have an adult child at home and you all three have jobs, so you need what? Guess what? Three cars. Is that crazy or what? But that's rational. It's rational to do that. But it's so insane to live like that. So we do need to imagine new communities condensing our footprint on the planet, moving back to cities and living in a different environment. I mean, you know, nobody wants to live in suburbs anyway. I mean, my friends who had kids growing up in the suburbs, as soon as they grew up, they got to be teenagers, they wanted to spend their time in Manhattan. They didn't want to be in the suburbs.
We have another call.
Yeah. So.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for the show. I just wanted to say that agriculture can be a big part of the solution. That if we sequester carbon in the soil, you know, agriculture right now is the problem, or one of the big problems, you know, up there with transportation and energy burning, you know, coal plants and so forth. And what we can do is sequester that carbon using creating fungal compost, and there are a number of other techniques we've talked about on the Farm and Garden Show. But just to remember that that's a way to have growth, perpetual growth, by growing food and, you know, growing natural fibers. There's going to be a total change in the way of life. And then as far as concrete, you know, there are applications where plastics are not so great. They burn really hot, as we discovered in a fire up here. Concrete would be a much better material. So you have to use the appropriate materials in the appropriate sites. But certainly reducing the use of concrete is another part. But just wanted to put in something about agriculture and that is a way to have a growth economy where we're growing plants and growing trees, growing food, growing fiber, and so forth.
All right. A different kind of growth economy. Thanks, Bill.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah. I mean, we need to reduce organic agriculture and abolish industrial farming. There's just nothing good about industrial farming, from cruelty to animals to pesticides and spraying a whole planet with pesticides stuff. This is so crazy. Who would do this? This is so insane.
That reminds me that there was just an article in the last week that the dead zone in the Caribbean is the largest ever recorded. And that's the runoff from coming down the Mississippi River from industrial farming in the Midwest.
Yeah, synthetic fertilizers and fossil fuel, synthetic fertilizers made from natural gas, and pesticides.
Okay, we have another call here.
But just a little point on that: we have much of our emissions and so forth and our pollutants are accidental, like a product of trying to make something else. But pesticides are the deliberate creation of toxic, poisonous chemicals that we then spray all over the planet. Is that crazy?
That's crazy. Are you sure they do that? Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for a great show. Well, personally, I'm a doomer. I'm a
little louder. I can't hear her.
I'm a doomer. I don't know if you know who we are, but we're students of Guy McPherson, who people say that he's too radical. However, I read an article that Tillerson wrote.
Annie, I can't hear her at all.
Okay, well, I'll repeat for you.
He said he was glad it was over because he didn't have to worry about it anymore. So there's a lot of knowledge in the government that we've already stepped over the line. I think that we need to, in our small communities, gear up for producing food and doing all the things we've talked about. But how we're going to get cooperation, that's the difficult thing. But I think we need to be kind, and we need to finally adopt some kind of philosophy of getting along. And I applaud your work. Keep up the good work. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So you couldn't hear that. She said she's a doomer, a student of Guy McPherson, and they think it's all over. And what we have to do now is get along and be kind and figure out how to make things work the best we can.
That's not a crazy approach. It is a fatalistic, hopeless approach. I don't subscribe to that, but it's possible we are doomed. I don't know. But, I think we can change. I'm not giving up hope.
We haven't given up yet. Okay, hang on. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, Annie and Steve, especially Steve. This is very disconcerting. You have to make sure your program does not run shallow. You should be able to question a man who, well-intentioned, is an agriculturalist and says that wood is not the way to go because it burns so fast and plastics burn so fast, and so you have to use cement, concrete. Not so. Have you ever heard of the word steel and metal? Steel and metal make a house half as heavy initially, right off the bat, and at less cost because there's a surplus of steel. Please question these callers. People may accept your word as gospel, and I love you both. Bye-bye again from Jim.
Okay, Jim.
Okay,
we're encouraging people's opinions here.
Yeah.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was responding to the caller earlier that had those three issues he thought would solve a lot of things, you know, the burning and all, and the oil. And I just wanted to bring up and see if you're aware that this country and the government running it has pro-burn for prescribed burns or even accidental burns in the forest. They'll let them burn. You know, oh, it's good for the habitat.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're burning military bases like Fort Ord. You can YouTube that. They're getting ready to burn it again, and that's like five wars of 10-foot-deep ammunition of C4 explosives, depleted uranium, high explosives. You know, that started in 97.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the things that nobody's accounting for, plus the pesticide use. This is hot. Those are hot metals. And when you vaporize and atomize metals, then it just lives in the ambient air, and they heat up. They're a lot hotter. So people are overlooking these pollution sources that are hot, and also the prescribed burning and methods for getting rid of hazardous waste and, you know, areas in the forest and in our own country, in our own backyards. And not just all global warming starting these burns or firebugs or whatever. It's these guys are letting it happen, you know. You go up, you say, hey, what about this fire here? And they go, oh, we're watching it. Well, why are you watching it? Why don't you go put it out? It's little. Oh, you know. So anyways, I just bring that up, and then the military base.
Okay, thank you so much. Okay, we're going to hold the calls for a while so that our guest has a chance to respond and to make some of his important points about what do we do about this. So the last caller just was complaining about the government's prescribed burns, which include burning ammo at Fort Ord, and also burning in the forest with the pesticides, which reminded me that we have that situation here of so-called green capitalism, where the Mendocino Redwood Company and Humboldt Redwood Company are certified sustainable, but we're
the certified sustainable business industrial complex, you could say. You know, this is a huge problem. Corporations can be persuaded to go green up to a point. That is, it's in their interest to recycle their waste, so they can save it and make more profit by recycling their waste. It's in their interest to create green products that they can sell. It's in their interest to do these kinds of things up to a certain point. But what they cannot do is to put themselves out of business to save the humans, and that's the problem we face. That to save the humans, we need to dramatically contract our economic footprint on the planet. The industrial companies, the industrial economies, I'm sorry, that is the U.S. and China and Japan and Europe and so forth, not the third world. Obviously, developing countries need, you know, the 400 million people in India don't even have electricity. So we need those people, that part of the world, the underdeveloped world needs to develop, but not along a capitalist consumerist mode. They need a different kind of development that produces good housing and jobs and decent food and schooling and healthcare and so forth, all those things they need. They don't need capitalist consumerism any more than we do.
Let me ask you a question on a little tangent, perhaps, from what you just said. But it's about driving themselves out of business. And I want to go back to the recession of 2008 when the finance sector did drive itself out of business. But then it got bailed out because they had the political abilities to do that through the government in Washington. So what do you think of that as a missed opportunity to sort of get the attention of the public of how important it is to make this kind of change? If they hadn't got bailed out, we'd have a different finance system today.
Yeah, we'd be in the midst of a depression.
unless it was rebuilt on a slightly different requirements that are slightly different system than existed before that. Right now, it's bailed out and it continues with the same kinds of values and the same, let's just call it just that value. So what do we have now? Another big real estate bubble. It's less than 10 years since the big bailout in the crash. And that's a 2 cents worth on the bubble. But that's what it looks like to me with prices going so high again in real estate just in the last, whatever, it's been 5 years or something.
Right. And then there's the student loan debt bubble, mm-hmm. and various other bubbles. In China, it's the housing bubble and so forth. I mean, every capitalist acts in, every corporation acts in their own perceived capitalist rational mode. But the net effect of all of those private decision making is periodic economic crises and collapse. That's happened time and again since the advent of capitalism. So it's an irrational system in which everybody tries to rationally act in their own interest, but that results in the net irrationality of the system as a whole. And so you get booms and busts. That's the business cycle. That's the way it works. But there's a deeper irrationality in the system, which is the ecological crisis, which is the most profound crisis of capitalism, at least in my view, and many others, the most profound and insoluble crisis of capitalism, because the response of capitalism has to be more of the same growth that's killing us. That's the problem. And while corporations can go green up to a certain point, they can't go very far. And so when people like James Hansen, the world's foremost climate scientist, and others say that, look, we need to dramatically cut fossil fuels, That has to translate into actual retrenchment and closures by actual companies that are shareholders that we might ourselves. I'm certain I have shares in fossil fuel companies in my retirement portfolio, as does every school teacher and every policeman and everybody who has any kind of retirement portfolio. That's the response of every worker in those industries. We all have a need to keep those industries going, and the collective irrationality of that is that we destroy the future for our children to hang on to our jobs today. This is the gravest, the most dire contradiction of capitalism today, and this is what we have to overcome. It seems so impossible to imagine another system. But we must imagine, we must liberate our imagination and think of utopias and think of ways. I tried to sketch out something in my sixth thesis paper, which I think is pretty reasonable. You know, it says that, you know, look, we need to, that capitalism is inexorably destroying us. We need to have a different kind of economy. You can call it socialism or eco-socialism or democracy, economic democracy, whatever you want to call it. But we need a completely different kind of economy, or we're doomed. And I contend that the only way to get a different kind of economy is to nationalize most of the corporate economy, nationalize the corporate economy, and plan it rationally. Vote it up or down. Vote for fossil fuels or not fossil fuels. Vote for public transportation versus private cars as the mainstay. Vote for pesticides or not pesticides. Vote for the big question. Ordinary working people, consuming people, ordinary people can vote these big questions, and then we hire the engineers and so forth to figure out how to do it. That's what the corporations do. Corporate boards decide on their strategic growth plan, and they vote it and they approve it, and then they hire staff and technicians and so forth to figure out how they want to do it. So Boeing wants to invest, wants to build its business in China. So it says, okay, so let's create a, let's, we have to create a design center in China, and we have to give them a piece of the assembly work and so forth. And so they approved that, and they did that, and that means the unemployment of workers in America and the employment of workers in China. This is something they vote on, approve, and do, and it has big implications for China and for the U.S. and for the world economy and the world environment. Those decisions that are made by corporations, though, are private decisions made in the interests of private shareholders, not public decisions made in the interest of the public. That's the contradiction. That's the problem. We need to have an economy that's basically democratic, that's made, built around democratic decision-making about what needs to be produced or not produced for the benefit of humanity and for our future generations and for other species with which we share this planet. So that's the argument that I try to make, that we need to have a systematic, rational, planned economy. We need to have a democracy to make that planning work, because I'm not an authoritarian. I'm not arguing for a kind of Stalinist planning, which was planning by a bureaucracy for the interests of the bureaucracy. I'm opposed to that completely. But I think that, and I gave a very good example of planning that in my sixth thesis paper and in my book, about planning in the management of public utilities, from Greg Palast and Gerald Oppenheimer's book, Democracy and Regulation, How the Public Can Govern Essential Services. They show it's really very, very interesting. They show that it's a curious and ironic fact in the U.S. that is like the world's leading champion of the free market, that there is a huge section of the economy which is not governed by the free market, but instead it's democratically governed by public oversight, and that's the utilities, the provision of electricity, mm-hmm. heating, fuel, water, and sewerage, local telephone service. Not only that, but these are the most efficient and cheapest utility systems in the world. It's really interesting. And so they show that there are in these meetings that they hold, the public utility meetings are open to the public, there are no secret meetings, no secret documents. Any and all citizens and groups are invited to take part, individuals, industrial customers, government agencies, consumer groups, trade unions, and the utility itself, even its competitors. Everyone who's affected by the outcome, I'm quoting, everyone who's affected by the outcome has a right to make their case openly, to ask questions of government utilities, to read all the financial and operating records in detail in the public forums, with all information open to all citizens. The principles of social dialogue and transparency come to life. It's an extraordinary exercise in democracy, and it works. I'm quoting directly from Palast and the other's book. It's a really interesting case. And this is, you know, they say this is no regulatory Garden of Eden. There are lots of failings, you know, and the public regulation is constantly under attack by promoters of market pricing and so on and so forth. But I see it as a real-world practical example of something like a kind of proto-socialism. And I see no obvious reason why something like this model of democracy and transparency could not be scaled up to encompass the entire industrial economy. Of course, we have to do much more than just regulate industries. We have to completely reorganize and reprioritize the whole economy, indeed the whole global economy. Mm-hmm. These are huge tasks, but we have a world of potential citizens and planners to do this, you know? Mm-hmm. What else? I mean, who else can do this but the self-organized masses of citizens, the whole society acting in concert mm-hmm. democratically? Okay, argument I try to make. And mm-hmm. I don't think this is so irrational, so crazy. Okay, and what other choice do we have?
Well, I agree. In the big picture of history, I look at it from the point of view that it's not it's not an issue whether we're going to go this direction. It's a matter of when we start going there, how much of the biosphere and our population is going to be left to support the population. Let me just remind listeners that we're hearing from Richard Smith, the author of the book Green Capitalism, The God That Failed. And I wanted to go back. You mentioned several good references. Let me mention one of them, because you talked about six theses a few minutes ago. You mentioned that. Now, that's a paper called Six Theses on Saving the Planet, and that is available at a website called thenextsystem.org. So for listeners that want to look that up later.
Yeah, there are a lot of other good papers on that website. I encourage people to really look that over. It's great. There's a lot of things. A couple of academics put that together 2 years ago. And invited a lot of people to write papers. Mine was one of them. And it's excited a lot of interest around the country.
Okay,
and
we have two lines waiting, so let's see what the call is.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much. This is Zebra, and I'd like to tell you about some progress regarding the One People's Public Trust.
Okay, let her rip.
I would hope that people have some familiarity with it already. I tried to publicize it in 2012 and 2013, but it has to do with some high-end UCC lawyers that went in and actually dissolved on a legal basis the concept of the corporation. But, of course, it's very complicated on the one hand, and on the other hand, it is kind of beneath people's interest, or somehow they just seem to think that I'm one of these people that have little basis in reality when I speak about it. But there are some breaking things happening right now. One of the actors behind the One People's Public Trust, her name is Heather Ann Tucci Giratt. So you see her name abbreviated as HATJ. There's some stuff on it on Rumor Mill News. It's a website that has a potpourri of open donation. But she got herself arrested and on this basis of the corporate law, and she's doing it as a test case. And apparently she's winning. So this is happening right now. She had a trial on Friday.
Oh, that recent.
And apparently it's looking really good.
Okay, so people can find out about that at One People's Public Trust, challenging to the corporate structure, and we're going to take another call. Hi, you're on the air. I guess they just backed away from their phones, so they're out of luck. Anyway, so we just have a short amount of time left, and our guest, who's been wonderful this afternoon, Richard Smith. Oh, here we go, another call. Let's get the people in here. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Am I on the air?
You are on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say, excellent show, wonderful guest. We figured out what the answer is.
All right.
And it's people working together. But that's exactly what's not going to happen, because this is the United States. And greed, we've seen, is that factor that we need to get out of the way so that we work together. But that's not going to happen, because this is the USA. It could have happened in insurance, for the insurance, for a lot of things. And I'm sorry that I'm pessimistic, but that's the way I see it now. I hope it changes.
Okay, well, maybe the rest of the world will go up against us here. So that the caller that was just on the air, Richard, she was saying that exactly what has to happen is the people need to work together, and then this is the USA, and they won't do it.
There are lots of reasons for pessimism, and I wouldn't say that's necessarily wrong, but there are, you know, it's interesting. What's interesting historically, if you look at huge social political crises, is that it's just in those crises when impossible things become possible. And, of course, sometimes that's worse. It's like Nazis, you know, took advantage of a crisis to take over Germany. So I'm not saying that, you know, it could necessarily always be good. But you do have these opportunities. And right now, in the United States, the middle ground has just fallen out, and politics is increasingly polarized. But it's very interesting to see, at the same time, of all these bad things, like the lady who just spoke said, nonetheless, you see a huge rejection, popular rejection of capitalism, especially among young people. You know, there's been article after article about the disillusionment with capitalism and even interest in socialism. And that's so strange and so interesting because where in America do you hear any propaganda supporting socialism? Not in the media, not in the schools or universities, nowhere, zero. And yet, somehow, Americans get this bizarre notion that capitalism is bad and socialism, some kind of democratic socialism, is good. Where do they get these crazy ideas? It's so interesting, but it is happening. And one idea, one thing, another example, which is also related to that, is the incredible influence of the Bernie Sanders campaign. Here's Bernie, a nominal socialist. I mean, he's really not so much more socialist than FDR in the 40s, but nonetheless, 30s and 40s, but nonetheless, he is so much of a socialist rhetorically and so anti-corporate in some respects that the Democratic Party just did everything they could to wipe him off the face of the map. And they were completely unsuccessful in, although they lost, and by so doing, by rejecting him and going with Hillary Clinton, they doomed the election and lost it. They lost that election. They didn't. The Republicans didn't win it. Trump was the most unpopular politician in the country up to the election, up to October. In November, he was the most unpopular politician in the country. He had like rates of approval in like 25-29%, and Hillary was barely above that. Whereas Bernie's rates of approval were always above 50%. And more, and he could easily have won that election. Now, the point is that right now there is a struggle for Medicare for all, for a single-payer system, and this goes against, tooth and nail, against the interest of the insurance complex, the insurance industrial complex, a completely parasitical sector of the economy that does nothing whatsoever except leech money out of the system. And so it's fighting tooth and nail, and also the Democratic Party. They don't want to go down this road, as what's her name said. You know, they won't accept single payer, and so they're dooming themselves to lose because single payer or Medicare for all is just overwhelmingly popular in the country. Like 50-70% of the population wants that kind of system, and there is a movement behind this, which Bernie has not single-handed, but is very heavily responsible for, and this is having a huge transformative effect. So I just want to close by saying that if we could win Medicare for all in this country, and what's so great about Medicare for all is it's not some kind of pie-in-the-sky socialism that doesn't work. It actually does work, and we have it. It just, the problem is it only applies to people over 65. But if you... The struggle has to be to reduce that age to zero, and that will solve the entire medical industrial problem. And of course, it'll put out the insurance company people out of work. Well, they need to be put out to work. We need to close down those industries and give those people other jobs. The struggle for Medicare for all should be combined with a jobs program for the people who need to be let go in the insurance industry. This is a winnable struggle.
We're going to stop you now.
We got to wind out. Let me mention a couple of websites. So we always do that at the end of our program. System Change, Not Climate Change, is a .org website for listeners that would like to have a look at your work there. And some other of your work is at www.richardanthonysmith.org.
And also I'd like to mention, because we didn't get time to get to this, but democracy has to be based on rough equality is another one of your important points. And apologies to the callers that we couldn't get on.
Yes, we have a couple lines lit up still for callers. Sorry we can't take those calls this evening or today.
That's it.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Glad to have you. All the calls that came in shows you really hit a nerve. So thanks for all the callers.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Okay.
Thanks to the callers, too. Okay.
Bye.
You've been listening to Corporations and Democracy, broadcast on 2nd and 4th Tuesdays here on KZYX and Z. It's 1 to 2 p.m. every 2nd and 4th Tuesdays. The next edition will be in 2 weeks, August 22nd. That's with our rotating hosts, Tony Rizzo and Linda McClure. And we will be back, Annie and I, on Tuesday, September 12th. For further information, you can go to The Alliance for Democracy.